Federal investigators have indicted an Oahu businessman, Michael Miskey, for murder, kidnapping, and more than a dozen other charges.
Among them, the alleged murder of 21-year-old Jonathan Fraser.
Miskey also allegedly went so far as to buy a Boston Whaler boat that could be used to dump Fraser's body into the ocean after he was kidnapped and he was killed.
The attorney for Miskey says he's a legitimate businessman and will prove so in court.
They need to be held accountable, and I hope this means that no one will ever get hurt again by these people.
Hey, True Crime Besties. Welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly. Hey everybody, welcome back to an all new episode of Serialistly with me, Annie Elise. I hope you guys are having a great start to your week, that you did something fun over the weekend, and I don't know whether you're commuting into work today or you're at home cleaning or maybe you're working out or you're running, whatever it is you're doing. I'm happy that you're with me and I'm happy that we're hanging out. I also want to let all of you guys know that the fall merch shop is officially open on our website, annieelise.com. Lots of sweatshirts, some t-shirts, a lot of things that sold out completely, not only at CrimeCon, but while we've been out on tour. But so many of you guys have been asking for them to come back, so we have them back. But here's the thing. The merch shop is going to close on October 26th. So you have to get your orders in now because then it closes. We are not going to open back up until the spring, possibly even early summer. So now is the time to grab those before they're gone. Again, get all of that at annieelise.com, but definitely check it out because it is up now. Now, what's interesting about the case that I'm going to be talking with you about today is it was actually recommended by one of you listeners. And this listener wants to stay anonymous for obvious reasons because there's like mobsters, hits, murder involved. I mean, it's very scary, but they tipped us off because they are involved with an extension of the family. I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to say which family. I'm not going to say what the extension is, but you get where I'm going. And this case actually takes us to Hawaii, which is pretty interesting because normally you think of Hawaii as like a vacation destination, right? You don't think of it as a place that has organized crime or these big, heavy mobsters, but it does. And what's happening in today's case is crazy because it takes us back to 2015, so not very long ago, 10 years ago, and a 21-year-old guy survived a horrific, horrific car crash, but then right after the crash, he vanished. And everybody knew exactly what happened to him. They knew where he had vanished to and who was responsible, because his best friend, who was also in that car crash with him, who unfortunately didn't survive, well, his dad was a mob boss and he was pissed. He was out for blood. He wanted revenge. So this case is full of twists and turns. It is full of like all sorts of things, a horrible revenge killing, chemical weapons, torture, a very gruesome death, and lots of questions. So let's get into it.
They may shoot at me and they miss. Ready, cool, or wrench? I promise, bro, it's gonna cost ya. It's gonna cost you, you're gonna cost you, I come in!
And the people that hurt him or had anything to do with this, they're going down. And I'm not fearing as this snitch or as this rat. I am light. I am love. I am a mama.
That they survived that, and that those two young men are not here with us today to raise the kiki, is beyond me.
This corruption in Hawaii ends with Johnny. He is our superhero. He is the reason why my children, our children, and all of the keiki of Hawaii can walk on the streets knowing that people like him will not be able to put hits on families like me.
Now, like I said, a lot of the times when we think about Hawaii, we think, okay, it's vacation, it's luau's, it's sunshine, it's the ocean, it's surfing. But at least if you're like me, sometimes you fail to remember that there's actually 500,000 people who live there. People who, it's not just tourists that go there, people who live there day in and day out, which means not only career people, but also career criminals who live there as well. But in addition to that, there's also people there who are just living their ordinary lives, right? And that includes people like Jonathan Frazier. In 2016, he was 21 years old, and he really looked like your typical surfer guy. He had long, wavy brown hair, hazel eyes, kind of this like slim surfer guy build. He loved pit bulls, loved hanging out with his friends. He also was a stoner. He loved smoking his weed. He smoked weed all the time. Now, Jonathan was also very, very into cars. Specifically, he was into racing them. He and his friends actually had an illegal racing club that they called Team Mad Dog, which can be a little dangerous, and, you know, everybody has their own opinions about that. Kind of a little sketchy, but other than the car racing, Jonathan was a really good kid overall. He never got into serious trouble. He also didn't have any type of record. He was just young, liked to have fun, liked to smoke weed, kind of made reckless decisions, and a good guy. So on November 17th, 2015, when Jonathan was still only 20 years old, he got a call from one of his best friends named Caleb Miskey. Now, like I said, Caleb and Jonathan were best friends, mainly because they had a lot of things in common. They both loved pit bulls, cars, racing, all of those typical guy things. And that was actually why Caleb was calling Jonathan that day. He just bought a brand new car and he wanted to show it off to his best friend. I mean, technically it wasn't new, it was used, it was a 1993 Honda Civic, but he managed to get it for just a little over $2,200. He bought it on Craigslist and he was so stoked. He wanted to show his friend. He's like, look at this car I just bought. We have to take it out. Like, can you even believe it? So Jonathan came over and reacted the way that you would expect a best friend to react when their friend just bought a new car. He was like, wow, this is great. Let's go out. Let's take it out for a spin. And so that's what they did. Caleb hopped behind the driver's seat. Jonathan rode alongside in the passenger seat and they took off and they were hitting all of their favorite spots along the way. They went to the mall. They met up with some friends. They went to a vape shop where Caleb and Jonathan loved to hang out all the time. And they just had complete freedom. They were having fun together. Then after they left the vape shop, Caleb decided, you know, I want to really see what this car can do, which given the fact that it was like 22 years old, I don't think that it really could have done much. But he's like, let's push it to its limits. Remember, they liked street racing after all. So he floored it and he just started speeding down the road. And I do mean speeding. He got this car to go 93 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone. He was going fast. But then they came up to an intersection right as a big Chevy truck was making a left turn. So now this truck was entering into their lane and they didn't have enough time to stop. They were going way too fast. So Caleb slammed into the truck. And I cannot overstate enough just how bad this wreck truly was, okay? It was absolutely terrible. The truck actually skid a full 37 feet before it came to a stop. And the Honda that Caleb was driving flew up into the air. It flew up and then came crashing back down onto the ground. This was a major car accident. And both Caleb and Jonathan, they were seriously hurt. So much so, in fact, that when Jonathan was admitted into the hospital, they had to put him into a medically induced coma. And Caleb had actually been trapped, pinned in this car that when the ambulance showed up, they had to use the jaws of life to remove him. Again, that's how bad this was. So after this rescue, both Caleb and his best friend Jonathan stayed in the hospital. They stayed at a facility called the Queens Hospital, and they lived there for the next few weeks, then few months. And during this time, given the circumstances and the injuries, it was questionable if either of these boys was even going to survive. Now, this car accident happened on November 17th, so Jonathan actually ended up missing Thanksgiving because he was in the hospital recovering. He didn't even get discharged out of the hospital until closer to Christmas or New Year's. I don't know the exact date of his release, but I do know that he spent most of the holiday season in the hospital. And sadly, Caleb, he had a harder time than Jonathan. He spent 4 months in the hospital, and after those 4 months, he didn't recover. He didn't get released. He died of his injuries that March. So now here was Jonathan, not only trying to still recover from his injuries, but also grieving and mourning the loss of his best friend. It had been a few months since the accident, but he was still in rough shape. And now, on top of that, you layer in that his best friend had died. And it didn't really seem that he had much of a support network as much as you would think that he would. See, Caleb's family was, of course, even more upset at the loss of Caleb than Jonathan was. I mean, how could they not be? This was their family member. I get it. It's a best friend, but still, it's a different level of loss. And they were grieving this horrendous loss. But at times, it was almost like they were taking their anger and their grief out on Jonathan, blaming him for this. For example, Caleb's father, Mike, from the day of the car accident onward, was very cold to Jonathan, very withdrawn, very withholding. He didn't want anything to do with Jonathan, and he acted almost like he couldn't care less about whether Jonathan even recovered or not. He wouldn't even let Jonathan come to Caleb's funeral after Caleb passed away. Which, I'll be honest, I understand giving a little bit of grace, because we don't know how we would react if we lost a child in a car accident. You know, you lose your son in this sudden, very violent accident, and maybe the last thing you want to see is a reminder of that accident, the best friend who was with him. Maybe that's too much of a trigger for you. But at the same time, Jonathan was Caleb's best friend, and Jonathan just wanted to say goodbye to him. So all in all, it was a very bad situation. Everyone was upset, everyone was grieving, and nobody could make it right. They were all just sort of like turning on one another. So after the funeral, after he's recovering, Jonathan was kind of just left on his own to grieve. He felt like people had turned against him, and he was having a really difficult time moving forward without his best friend Caleb anymore. According to Jonathan's girlfriend, Ashley Wong, he just could not let go of him. And he even had this one particular smoke shop that he went to all of the time. It was the smoke shop, in fact, where he and Caleb used to hang out all the time together. And it was one of the last places that they ever had gone together on the day of that car accident. So this smoke shop had a lot of memories and a lot of meaning to Jonathan. And I'm sure for him, it was almost like this way of saying goodbye to him, letting him go, because remember, he wasn't even allowed to go to the actual funeral. So here was this place that was so important to them that they would frequent often together, and he was there trying to, I don't know if you would say grieve, mourn, say goodbye, but somewhere that held a lot of importance in his heart. So he's grieving on his own and trying to find his way forward. But then in April of 2016, somebody completely unexpected reached out to Jonathan, somebody who he never expected to hear from again. It was Caleb's dad, Mike. And from the sounds of it, Mike said a bunch of things kind of like, look, I shouldn't have turned on you. I overreacted. It's not your fault, and it's not you who caused the accident. I was just grieving. I lost my son, and I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have taken it out on you. You know what? You were his best friend. I'm his father. We will get through this together. So now Mike really wanted to make things up to Jonathan. He wanted to do nice things for him after he had treated him so badly. And what I mean by that is Mike was a really successful businessman. He owned his own pest extermination type company, and he had made a lot of money over the years. So he started lavishing Jonathan with all of these incredible gifts. I mean, first he was like, hey, do you have a good place to live? No? Let me give you a place to stay, rent free. Hey, do you need a car? Let me give you a car so you can get around, just trying to do whatever he could to make Jonathan's life easier. He kept showering Jonathan with presents, and it almost became like he was doing too much or being too generous, if that makes sense. Then on July 30th, Mike paid for Jonathan's girlfriend Ashley to go to this very fancy spa, saying, you know, you've been working so hard taking care of Jonathan. She also was pregnant at the time with Jonathan's baby, so saying you need some time to just focus on you. Just kick back, relax, this is on me. You deserve some self-care. So Ashley was thrilled, of course. I mean, who wouldn't be? So that day, on the 30th, Ashley headed to the spa, and she wasn't alone. She had a friend with her. Now, this friend was Caleb's widow. So now you have the two women of these two best friend guys, one unfortunately who had passed away, so she's now a widow, and then the other one who's pregnant with Jonathan's child, and they had been taking care of them together, they had gone through so much together, and now they were at this day spa to just relax and have a day of self-care that was fully funded by Caleb's father, Mike. So the two of them spent the day there enjoying themselves, relaxing, having a good time, and just, you know, hanging out. Then after the spa was over, Ashley went home. But when she got home that evening and went inside, Jonathan was nowhere to be found. She looked around trying to see where he was. Maybe he was in a room, maybe he was out front, maybe out back, but he wasn't anywhere. He was missing. It was like he vanished. Today's episode is sponsored by Kettle and Fire. Now, do you ever feel like you're doing everything right? You know, working out, eating clean, but still dealing with bloating or cravings or low energy? Because that used to be me. But that is until I found an easier upgrade for my wellness routine, which is Kettle and Fire bone broth. Now, let me just tell you, okay? This bone broth, it is rich, savory, it's low simmered for over 20 hours, so it actually tastes amazing, yet it's also really, really good for you. Each serving packs up to 19 grams of protein, and it's made with 100% grass-fed and finished beef bones or organic free-range chicken bones. There's no additives, no preservatives, no weird stuff, just clean, real ingredients that your body recognizes. And I love that I can just say, heat it up, sip it, and go. I can do it in the morning. It can be this quick little protein-packed start to the day or a snack in the middle of the day. It kind of keeps me through that like 3 p.m. slump. In the evening, you can also drink it as like this little like warm, cozy treat, especially now that the weather is changing, just to, you know, wind down. And daily sipping supports gut health and digestion, muscle recovery, and energy, plus immune function, all without changing your whole routine. And for a limited time, you can get a free carton of Kettle and Fire bone broth by going to kettleandfire.com/AE. You can also grab Kettle and Fire in over 22,000 stores nationwide, including Costco, Walmart, Target, and Whole Foods. So again, that's kettleandfire.com/AE to claim your free carton and taste real nourishment you can feel good about. Today's episode is also sponsored by Everyday Dose. Now, I have talked to you about Everyday Dose so many times, but truly, it's because I love it. If you're like me, or I should say like my husband, and you like live for your morning caffeine, or morning coffee more specifically, you know, the taste, the ritual, but don't always love what it does to your stomach, such as bloating, jittery crashing mid-morning, things like that, that's where Everyday Dose really steps in and changes the game completely. I've had so many friends tell me that they've tried Everyday Dose too, and that they just love it because it's coffee plus benefits. They combine high quality coffee with really powerful ingredients like lion's mane, collagen protein, nootropics. I mean, all these things to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. And the best part is it tastes just like coffee, but you don't feel that downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, steady energy that actually makes you feel good. And the best part, you can now find Everyday Dose in Target stores across the country. So celebrate with a buy one, get one deal. Just buy any two Everyday Dose products at a Target near you, and they'll pay you back for one of them. Visit everydaydose.com/serialistly for all the details. That's everydaydose.com/serialistly. Your daily ritual upgraded. So as soon as Ashley realized that Jonathan wasn't home, she knew that something was wrong. It wasn't Jonathan's personality for him to just leave late at night without telling anybody where he was going. And remember, he had just been through this ridiculously long medical recovery. Of course he would communicate where he was going or what was going on. He knew how many people cared about him, how many people were worried about him. He wouldn't just disappear. She also knew that as sad as Jonathan was about losing his best friend, he wouldn't have run away or done something to himself or taken his own life, because while he was in the hospital, it's almost as though he had this wake-up call or like big moment of clarity where he realized just how much he truly appreciated life. So now that he's gone, she knew that something was wrong and she had a pit in her stomach. She could feel that something wasn't right here. Yet she, of course, didn't want to jump to conclusions. So before getting erratic or panicking right away, she just tried calling Jonathan, seeing if she could get a hold of him. And she kept dialing his number again and again, but he wasn't answering. And every time she would call, it would just get all the more clear that he was not going to answer. So then Ashley reached out to Jonathan's other friends and family members, and she asked them if any of them had heard from Jonathan. Had he said something to anybody about having plans or maybe going somewhere else? But nobody had an answer for her. Nobody had heard from Jonathan, and nobody had any idea where he could be. In fact, his parents were really nervous when Ashley reached out because, like her, they knew he would never just, like, drop off the face of the earth and, like, go off the grid. He was way too responsible to do that. So now they were panicking as well. So all night long, Jonathan's parents and Ashley were just driving all over town, stopping at all of the possible places that he could be at, the vape shop, the local market, anywhere he may have stopped, checking in with friends, checking in with family. But there was no sign of him. Nobody had the faintest idea of where he could have been. So by the next morning, with no leads, no idea, and no answers, they knew that they weren't going to find Jonathan on their own. So they decided to go to the police and report him as missing. This was on July 31st. Now, the good news is the police took the disappearance very seriously. They weren't waiting around. They weren't saying, oh, maybe he just ran away. Maybe he's with friends. Maybe he'll turn up. They knew that this was a serious situation, and they acted pretty much immediately. And the reason that they knew this was so serious, they based it off of two things. First, they took Ashley seriously when she said that this wasn't Jonathan's personality. She was very insistent and very adamant that Jonathan would not take off on his own.
He was just really blessed to be alive at this point because he, like I said, the accident was really bad and we are expecting, so he was very excited about that. So his main goal was just pretty much to recover and become better than he was before.
So to their credit, the cops believed her. They were like, okay, we accept what you're saying. We believe you that this is not what he's like. So they got to investigating. And just 1 week after Jonathan was reported missing, his car ended up turning up. It had been parked in this completely random place. It was a town called Hawaii Kai, and Jonathan never went there. He didn't have any friends there. There also weren't any stores or shops that he liked to visit there. There was just no reason for him to ever be there. So this was just yet another clue that Jonathan's disappearance must have been due to foul play. It seemed like somebody must have hurt him and then dumped his car there. And there was one other detail to support this that really stood out to the investigator, something that they could not ignore. Because so often, as we know, when somebody goes missing, one of the very first questions is, okay, did they have any enemies? Is there anybody who may want to hurt them? Was there anybody who may have an axe to grind with them? And every single person who knew Jonathan, his parents, his girlfriend Ashley, his friends, literally everyone, they all agreed. Yeah, Jonathan did have an enemy. There was someone who was very dangerous and capable of hurting or even killing Jonathan. And that person was his best friend Caleb's father, Mike. See, when I said earlier that Mike worked for that exterminator business, that was only half the story. Because the truth was that Mike was literally a crime boss. The pest control business was all a front. It was to cover for the real way that he made his money. The reality was that he was a part of an Oahu-based organized crime outfit called the North Shore Boys, which I'm talking about a very violent and very dangerous guy. And as it turns out, he had been wanting to hurt or kill Jonathan for quite some time. But before we get into all of that, let's talk a little bit about Mike's history and the kind of guy that he was. Now, as far as we can tell, he has been involved in organized crime for quite some time, going all the way back to the 1990s. It began with things like, you know, beating people up, assaults, trying to intimidate people to either come and work for them or to pay them, teach people a lesson if he felt like they had wronged him or one of his bosses. I mean, the typical stuff that you think of when you picture the mafia or the Sopranos or, you know, anybody in the mob. But then by 2016, Mike was committing much more serious crimes than that. And these crimes actually include a lot of evidence and details that haven't even been made public yet. So I apologize that it's not super detailed, but, you know, I can only share what I know. Now, what we do know is that by 2016, Mike had started committing these armed robberies, trying to steal drugs for all these different gang members to sell. Literally, one time, he and another associate even found out where a rival gang's drug dealers were going to go out driving around, canvassing the area. So Mike and another colleague of his pulled up in two different cars, one of them parked in front of the rival driver and then one of them parked behind him, just trapping him in, barricading him in so that they couldn't get away. Then they robbed this person at gunpoint. Which, this next detail is very weird, but during the crime, Mike's associate apparently dressed up as a police officer. I'm not sure how that helped the heist or if it was to make it so that he didn't know, he thought it was police who were barricading him in and didn't know that this was going to be some sort of like mob robbery or what. But in any event, that's what they did. And he did this multiple times, stealing meth and also what court documents called controlled substances, which I'm not sure if that means heroin, LSD, weed, cocaine, or something else, but the point is, he was definitely up to some bad and very serious stuff. Then, also around 2016, he apparently got a tip that one of their former colleagues, or one of their current colleagues, I'm not entirely sure, was working with the police, that they had turned on the North Shore Boys. They were cooperating. So Mike killed that person. And I don't know the victim's name, their gender, or anything about them, but you will notice that I am now not saying allegedly or reportedly, because the police actually know that he committed this murder, even though they've never named the victim or any other real details about the crime yet. Then he attempted another murder on May 23rd, 2017. Again, we don't know who the victim was, and this time around, I don't know why Mike wanted to kill them. All I know is that Mike shot them, and this person survived the shooting. Which, if you're paying attention to the timeline and the dates that I'm throwing out, then you probably are noting that that murder and the attempted murder happened after that car crash with Jonathan and Caleb, and also after Jonathan went missing. Which, not good, but I will get into that later. So jumping ahead to October of 2017, Mike and some of these North Shore boys ended up kidnapping another person. They put this person inside a car and left them restrained, which I'm not exactly sure how the situation played out because, again, this was a case where the police have not released a whole lot of information and there's not a whole lot that we know publicly. But clearly, Mike was a very dangerous guy. And the only reason he didn't have a longer record was because the police didn't have any hard evidence to nail him with. And understandably, with his organized crime connections, a lot of witnesses and survivors were way too afraid to even stand up to him or file police reports against him. And there's one other story I quickly want to tell you about Mike and about the kind of stuff that he pulled, just to give you a clear idea of who this man was, because it actually is so insane. And it's going to sound like I'm making stuff up, but I promise you, I'm not. This story is completely true. But see, Mike owned a nightclub. It was just another business for him, a way for him to make money. However, it wasn't as profitable as he wanted it to be. So because of that, Mike blamed these other two nightclubs that were just up the street from his, a place called The District and another one called Jinza. The District was super popular and very trendy, and Mike felt like the best way to convince people to stop going there and instead start coming to his nightclub was to make the regulars at the District feel unsafe. Like, okay, if they're too scared to go to the District, they're still going to want a party, they'll come to our club, they'll come over to my place. So on March 4th, 2017, he sent one of his associates, one of his thugs, to go over to the District. And when he got over there, this associate poured a canister of insect poison in a trash can. Then all of the fumes and the gases just kind of came like bubbling up and poisoned all of the people who were dancing. And the specific chemical that he used was actually classified as a chemical weapon. And it was classified as being too dangerous to even be used in World War I, so it was pulled from it. It's very deadly and it's banned in any sort of battlefields these days. That's how bad it is. Now, the workaround here is that it's legal to use this chemical against termites. And remember, he owns that extermination business. But he wasn't using it for termites. Instead, he sent one of his associates to go unleash this deadly chemical on a bunch of people dancing at a nightclub so that he would then get the traffic in turn because people would be too scared to go there again. Now, thankfully, after this poison was released, people started vomiting right away, their eyes were itching, they knew that something was wrong, so emergency services were called immediately. The fire department came, ambulances came, and luckily nobody was seriously injured. They got out in time. But once people in the area who owned other clubs heard about what was going on, they started amping up security. They were nervous. They were like, okay, if that club was a target, why wouldn't ours be? But Mike's takeaway from all of that was, no, I'm gonna now do another chemical attack. So the second incident was on the very next night on March 5th. And this time, he paid some woman $3,000 to go to another nightclub and release this canister of poison. According to her, she didn't realize how deadly the poison was. She thought that she was just releasing pepper spray, as if that's any better. But still, she understood that she was attacking innocent people who were just there to dance and have a good time, and she went along with it because, to her, the $3,000 was more important than somebody's safety. Now, the reason he hired her instead of having one of his associates go and do it is because since they had amped up the security, he figured, okay, a girl is probably more likely to go under the radar. Security probably won't suspect them or think twice of it, which he was right. They didn't think twice about it. So she got into this club, and he ended up going to the club a little while later. He wanted to make sure that everything was going according to plan. In fact, he actually wanted to see all of these people in the club inhale this poison and watch his handiwork unfold, which, talk about sick. So Ashlyn waited until just after midnight, and she released the poison, but she didn't dump it in a trash can like what they did during the first attack. Instead, she pushed her way out to the center of the dance floor, opened the canister, and she dumped it right there, right where everybody was dancing. Which I'm happy to say, once again, nobody was seriously injured or hurt, except, I mean, ironically, Ashlyn was, because she was the one who was pouring this chemical, so she ended up burning her skin, her eyes got messed up, but ultimately she was able to sneak out and get away, and she was fine. She wasn't seriously harmed. I wanted to tell you this story because it just goes to show you what kind of guy Mike was. Which, you might be thinking, okay, mob boss and crazy organized crime lunatic is one thing. How does somebody like that get involved with a 20-year-old like Jonathan, who was his son's best friend? Well, the truth is, Mike blamed Jonathan for Caleb's death. And he felt like he needed revenge. He felt like Jonathan had to die and he had to pay for taking his son away. I'm gonna be real with you. You can't even begin to imagine all the money that I have spent on skincare or beauty products over the years, trying to fix things like dryness, breakouts, hair damage, because, you know, I bleach my hair. But I recently realized that I was completely overlooking one of the most important factors in all of this, the water that I shower in. Now, I brought this up, I think, a couple of months ago. I first saw it all over my TikTok feed, and I was like, I need to try this. Like, what's the scoop here? What's the real situation? And I am so, so happy I did. We all know how important it is to filter the water that we drink, so I don't know why we don't think the same way about the water that we shower in, but that's where Jolie comes in. Jolie is a beauty wellness company that purifies the water that we shower in so that we get better skin, hair, I mean, just overall well-being. Their filtered shower head is best in class for removing chlorine and heavy metals, all the stuff that can cause irritation, dryness, and even color fading. It's also the only lab-tested and clinically validated filtering shower head on the market. It's proven to reduce hair shedding in 81% of people, also reduce frizziness by 40%, and even help retain moisture and color. Plus, it's so easy to install. It looks beautiful. I'm sure you've seen one of these on your social media pages somewhere, and it works with almost any plumbing setup. And Jolie will give you your best skin and hair guaranteed. Head to jolieskinco.com/AE to try it out for yourself with free shipping. And if you don't love it, you can return your Jolie for a full refund within 60 days. No questions asked. So again, that's jolieskinco.com/AE. Clean water, better beauty. Today's episode is sponsored by O Positive. O Positive is a women's health company that creates real, tangible results with ingredients that are backed by clinical studies and shaped by board-certified doctors. They offer supplements that support women at every stage of life, from their first period to well beyond their last. And they've got multiple bestsellers at Target and on Amazon. Now, one of my favorites that I have tried, and I have talked to you about it before, is the Urovaginal Probiotic. It's a daily probiotic blend that's formulated to support vaginal health by balancing your pH, healthy flora, all the good things that make you just feel confident, secure, and, you know, balanced. And here's why that matters. So many factors like tight clothing, workouts, hormones, even periods can throw things off, leading to discomfort, odor, or a pH imbalance. But Uro uses four clinically studied probiotic strands plus prebiotics to help restore the natural balance and keep you feeling confident and comfortable. And when taken daily, many women notice benefits within 8 weeks, some even sooner. It's a small daily step that can make a big difference in your confidence and overall well-being. So take proactive care of your health and head to opositive.com/AE or enter AE at checkout for 25% off your first purchase. That's opositive.com/AE for 25% off. Now, for the record, Mike should not have blamed Jonathan for Caleb's death because all of the evidence, all of the crime scene, everything indicated Caleb was the one driving. He was behind the wheel. He's the one who chose to floor it and speed and drive recklessly, not Jonathan. And there's no way that that evidence could have even been fabricated because, like I said, Caleb had been pinned in the car. He was pinned in the driver's seat and they had to come and use the jaws of life to extract him from the car. So it was clear that he was the driver here. There were also several witnesses who saw the wreck happen, so there was no question on anybody's mind. It was Caleb who was driving. But in spite of all of that, Mike was always insisting to anyone and everyone who would listen that actually it was Jonathan who was driving the car that day. He must have caused the accident. He must have been the one responsible for Caleb's death. And I don't know if this was because, like himself, never taking responsibility and trying to rope other people and make it everybody else's problem. I don't know if maybe this was like that by proxy. And by extension, he was saying, this isn't my son's fault. It couldn't have been his fault. We're not going to accept responsibility. I don't know. But for whatever reason, he was hell-bent on blaming Jonathan. Jonathan had to pay. He was the one responsible. And it was actually super obvious to everyone who knew Mike that he had it in for Jonathan. I mean, yes, he did recently start extending some niceties to him, offering him the car, a place to stay rent-free, paying for his girlfriend to go to the spa. But up until then, when Caleb and Jonathan were both in the hospital fighting for their lives, Mike would come in regularly, and he would just rant and rave about how terrible Jonathan was, how he was the one who got Caleb hurt. Then, after Caleb's death, these rants turned into complaints about how Jonathan had killed him, how he was the one responsible. Then, as we know, Jonathan ended up going missing just a couple of months later. Now, Jonathan's mother, Shelley, knew from day one that Jonathan did not go missing on purpose, and she also knew that he hadn't gone missing due to an accident. From the very beginning, the exact same day that she reported him missing, Shelley knew in the pit of her stomach that he had been kidnapped. She also knew that he might have been murdered. She knew that this situation was not looking good at all. Now, as for Jonathan's girlfriend, Ashley, Ashley was also very suspicious of Mike at first. I mean, when he came out of the woodworks and started giving them all of those gifts, setting them up with a place to live, giving Jonathan cars, she wasn't really sure what to think of it. It felt a little weird, but he was being nice, and it seemed like this was the new norm. So as time went on and Mike continued to be nice, she started letting her guard down, thinking that maybe he really did just want to make things up to Jonathan. So, like Jonathan, she too let Mike into her life. But by the time she realized that he was up to no good, it was too late. Jonathan had already disappeared. And she actually gave an interview later on talking about the night of Jonathan's disappearance. She described the thoughts that were running through her head when she started piecing everything together and when she really came to the realization that Mike had actually, in fact, been setting them up this entire time just so that he would have an opportunity to hurt Jonathan. She said, quote, "This wasn't happening. There was no freaking way. Why would he give us that car? Why would he put us in this house? Why did I not see all of these things? I was pissed off, and it came to me instantly, all of the red flags that anyone could have seen." And you might remember earlier how I said that Ashley spent the entire night of July 30th out looking for Jonathan, you know, before she reported him missing the following morning. But what I didn't mention is that one of the very first places that she went looking for Jonathan was at Mike's house, because she knew right in that moment that if Jonathan was still alive, he had to be at Mike's house. He had to be there, and he was probably Mike's hostage. Now, when Ashley got to Mike's house, it was all dark. Nobody was home, which was, of course, a very bad sign. But Ashley didn't want to give up. So she actually decided to call Mike to say, "Hey, what are you up to? Where are you? What are you doing?" And Mike was just like, "Oh, I'm at home. It's late at night. I'm getting ready for bed." And Ashley took it a step further, which I gotta give her credit. She has got balls of steel. Because in that moment, she knew he was lying, right? She was looking at a dark house. Nobody was there. So she straight up told Mike right there on the phone. She's like, "I know that you're lying.
And the people that hurt him or had anything to do with this, they're going down. And I'm not fearing, as this snitch or as this rat, I am light, I am love, I am a mama."
From that day onward, Ashley was all about raising awareness of Jonathan's disappearance and possible murder. She wanted people to know what had happened to him. She wanted a conviction. She also wanted Jonathan's body to be found so that she could have a proper burial for him. So Ashley would spend time hanging posters, doing interviews, spreading the word as much as she possibly could. She also ran various social media pages hoping that anybody would come forward, whether anonymously or publicly, with tips, something that would lead to answers.
"So we deserve to know what happened. We deserve to know where John is."
Ashley Wong tells me she last saw Frazier when she left their Hawaii Kai apartment on July 30th, 2016, and never saw him again. They found his car on Kuli'o Road 8 days later.
Wong tells me that Frazier didn't know anybody who lives in this neighborhood, so she couldn't think of a logical reason why his car would wind up here.
Wong tells me it's possible that Frazier was still feeling the effects of the car crash that happened months before he disappeared. He and his best friend were rushed to the hospital in critical condition. His friend died months later.
"Mentally, he didn't recover. He would go to the vape shop every day because that's where he last saw his best friend."
Now, through all of this, she was completely convinced that Mike was the one responsible, that Mike had hunted and killed Jonathan. And in fact, during all of this, Mike sent her a text message that was in all caps, like he was screaming, where he said, "Stop saying that Caleb was the driver of the car." As if that is what he was the most concerned about in that moment. Not Jonathan's disappearance, not his probable murder, but still defending his son's reputation. And it's not like the police were only hearing from Ashley and Jonathan's mom, Shelley, that they thought Mike was responsible. They were getting tips from all over. So many people were calling in anonymously from the island saying, yo, Mike has a personal grudge against Jonathan. His gang members would also be willing to kill anybody for Mike if he gave them the instruction. But the unfortunate thing was that none of those tips were really actionable. Basically, people were calling to say, yeah, Mike killed Jonathan, Mike's a murderer, look at Mike, but none of the tipsters were able to offer real evidence. And even though the police were, yes, investigating Mike, and they had a lot of suspicions that he was this bad, horrible, dangerous man, this literal gangster, they couldn't prove any of it. Meanwhile, Mike still had his eyes on the prize. He was laser focused on the end result and what he wanted. In fact, he even started on this while Jonathan was still in the hospital.
They approached me when they was in the hospital that Mike Miskey wants to hire me to kill Johnny Frazier.
Tonight, Lindsay Kinney says one of Miskey's associates offered him $50,000 to kill a friend of Miskey's son, but he turned it down.
Kinney says turning down the hit made him a target, literally, as he later dodged their bullets.
Now, this next part of the story is very frustrating and very upsetting, but one man reached out to the police. His name is James, and according to James, he actually saw Jonathan on the day that he went missing. He went over to Mike's house and Jonathan was there, but he wasn't there as a friend or an acquaintance or anything casual. He was tied up in a plastic green chair. He had zip ties holding his arms and legs in place. There was also blood all over his face like somebody had beat him up.
According to the records, Boiling Solace, labeled CS for confidential source, said he saw Frazier tied to a green plastic garden chair with zip tie restraints and duct tape. He had a bloodied face. Jake Smith and Lance Bermudez, associates of Miskey, started burning Frazier's feet and hands and eventually worked their way up Frazier's body with a propane gas torch.
Now, this next detail is crazy and it might make your stomach turn. But days later, James returned to the house and he saw a big pot of water just sitting there on the stove. There was also this large bone with this piece of meat that was cooking in this pot, and the meat was like falling off of the bone. But James thought to himself, like, this doesn't look like some ordinary piece of beef or pork or something like that. And he didn't say how he knew, but he said he knew that it was a human bone. He had witnessed that torture session, after all, so now he was convinced that this was Jonathan's body. So he was so disturbed by all of this that he went straight home and he told his mom. He told his mom, Janet, everything that he had seen. And Janet was kind of like, okay, well, you know what you have to do. You have to go tell the police what you saw. But James didn't want to be a snitch. He knew that it could be very dangerous to double-cross Mike. He didn't want to be the one ratting him out. But luckily, his mother raised him right, and he went to the station and decided to just spill his guts about everything, and he said Mike had definitely murdered Jonathan. The problem was, James also had a history of drug use and drug dealing. He had violated his probation somewhere along the way, and the police knew it, so even though he was there doing the right thing, he still got arrested and was sent to jail. The hope was, though, that he could probably cut a deal, maybe testify against Mike in exchange for a lighter sentence. However, it did not work out that way. Instead, as soon as James got thrown in jail, all of the other inmates started coming up to him, telling him, you know, you're gonna pay. You are gonna pay for turning against Mike. You will never live to testify against him. Then one day, somebody did jump and attack James. Now, we don't know who this person was, because during the attack, James was hit unconscious because it was such a bad attack, and he went into the hospital. Then, once in the hospital, he spent 2 weeks on life support and never woke up. The doctors told his mother that there was no chance of recovery. He was not going to recover. It wasn't medically possible. So she asked if they would release him so that he could die in the comfort of his own home. The jail agreed. He was released to his mother, and he died inside their home at just 23 years old.
James, this is mommy. This is mommy, James. I love you.
December 28th, Janet Salas sees her son, James Borling Salas, for the first time since he was sent to OCCC for violating probation.
Tubes out of his mouth, his nose, everything, and now we gotta make a decision on whether my son is gonna stay like that for the rest of his life or if we're gonna let him go.
Salas says no one from the public safety department reached out to her. It was other inmates who called to tell her a week later that he was hospitalized after an attack they said happened in Annex 1 of the jail. She says a brain scan showed severe damage. He remained at the Queens Medical Center under guard until mid-January, until a judge released him and he was moved into home hospice care.
I brought him home. I brought him home on the 15th of January. On the 16th of January, he took his last breath of me in my room.
So now the police were back to square one. They didn't have James to testify against him. They had very little evidence. They couldn't have anybody who would be able to testify at trial. Like, what were they going to do?
They tortured him. They tortured him. Like it's a game.
Kinney says he lives with regret, knowing he could have saved Frazier's life.
When they went offer me that money, what I supposed to do is go to that hospital and grab that boy. I know I could have saved him. That's the only thing I did wrong. That's the only weight I get on my shoulders.
And keep in mind that by 2017, this was now when all these gas and chemical attacks were happening on the nightclub, they still hadn't found Jonathan's body, so they still couldn't prove that he had even been murdered, even though all of these tipsters called in saying either they witnessed it, they knew that Mike did it, we know James had said that he witnessed the torture, and then saw, you know, the bone and meat on the stove, disgusting, but they had no proof. They didn't have Jonathan's body. They also didn't have any evidence against him. And now, like I said, they don't have the person who was going to testify against Mike. So they needed more if they were going to actually act on anything. In the meantime, Ashley gave birth to Jonathan's son. This was a baby who was born without his father, who had no idea of where Jonathan could even be. Yet still, the police were at a standstill. There was nothing that they could do. Then, in late May of 2018, the FBI started getting involved. They teamed up with the local Hawaiian police to try and get this case solved once and for all.
The FBI is not ruling anything off the table at this point. We're going to be pursuing all logical leads.
The FBI says they are not ruling out foul play and that there are persons of interest in the case. While Honolulu police normally investigates missing persons cases, Special Agent La'anui tells us that the persons of interest could fall under FBI jurisdiction.
Now that the FBI was involved, they actually offered a reward of $20,000. And this reward was for any information that would lead to an arrest. And that had to be tempting, for sure. I mean, 20 grand. But still, people were scared. Nobody wanted to come forward. So the case was at a standstill. And it stayed that way until 2022, until something major happened, something that happened that finally managed the police to break everything wide open. Okay, I'm going to tell you about a little snack hack that I learned. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Your fridge is fully stocked with, you know, good intentions, veggies, greens, all the things that you swore you were going to cook this week. But then by Thursday, you're right back at the drive-thru. Trust me, I get it. That is my life. I live it. Life gets busy, and it is so easy to sacrifice quality nutrition for convenience. But that's why I've also been obsessed with Cachava lately. It has made my life so much easier and so much better, if I'm being honest, because they have delicious whole body nutrition that actually tastes good. Now that I've been using Cachava for a few months, I have noticed some real changes. Steady energy all day long. My digestion feels great. I'm not constantly reaching for snacks. And it's packed with vitamins, minerals, probiotics, and plant-based protein. And it just genuinely makes me feel better, okay? Now, my personal favorite right now is the chai flavor, especially with a little like nut milk and ice blended in with it. It's perfect for like fall, these cozier days. It's kind of giving, you know, cozy fall vibes, but still totally clean and nourishing. And with every two scoops of Cachava, you get over 85 superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. No artificial flavors, no sweeteners, no soy, no gluten, no preservatives, just real food that tastes amazing. Your future self will thank you. Go to Cachava.com and use code AE for 15% off your next order. That's Cachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code AE for 15% off. Now, you might remember that Jonathan went missing on July 30th, 2016. And about 2 weeks later, in mid-August, a member of Mike's gang made a very, very big mistake. His name was Kelly, and he was 25 or 26 years old, but he had been working with Mike for quite a while at this point. You know, doing odd jobs here, selling drugs, dealing drugs, generally kind of just being, you know, a crappy person and almost like the person who takes orders from Mike. So either on August 13th or August 20th, the police haven't been entirely clear or sure on what the exact date was, but he went to a cockfight. And he got there around noon. He started buying some merch, which apparently is something that they sell at cockfights. I don't understand it, but okay, sure. So he starts buying merch, hanging out at this cockfight, and then he starts bragging. He starts trying to act like, you know, a big tough guy. And the thing that he was bragging about? He said that he personally was the one who murdered Jonathan and that it was all on Mike's orders. And as he told it, the day of the murder, he waited for Jonathan's girlfriend Ashley to leave for her spa day. Then, once he was sure that Jonathan was alone, he went to the house, grabbed Jonathan, and dragged him out to his car. As they drove to the shore, he and Jonathan then got onto a yacht, and I'm not sure if he was physically dragging Jonathan around or if he was maybe using a gun to threaten him, and that's why Jonathan was not cooperating, but, you know, kind of going with him. But somehow, he convinced Jonathan to sit on board with him while they drove out to the middle of the ocean. And then he tied cement blocks to his feet and shoved him into the water. Now, when you see movies and TV shows about people getting pushed into the ocean with cement shoes, it makes it look like they sink immediately, right? Cement is heavy. But apparently, even with these cement blocks that were attached to his feet, Jonathan was able to swim a little bit. He was thrashing his arms around, doing everything that he could do to keep his head above water. And the whole time, this creep just watched him struggle. Finally, Jonathan got too tired. He couldn't stay in that position, treading water forever, and when he couldn't fight the weight of those blocks on his feet anymore, he just went underwater, and he never came back up. Now, there are a few details about this story that he told that are really important. I mean, first of all, he was talking about committing this horrible murder to a place that had at least 100 people attending. I mean, there were a lot of people. A lot of people heard him talking. And the other important thing is, as he was regurgitating this story, he kept saying we. He wasn't saying I, he was saying we took him out, we did this, we tied cement blocks. He didn't say who the other person was, or if it was another person or multiple other people, but it was very clear that he had murdered Jonathan for Mike, and that he didn't act alone. But even with all of this information, the police still did not have a smoking gun. They still hadn't found Jonathan's body, so not only could they not prove that he was dead, but they certainly couldn't prove that Mike was the one who killed him or that he, remember, had even been killed at all. However, the police did think that with this confession from his little goon, that they had enough to arrest Mike, although they now needed this confession to happen again, not just in a room full of people, but this time on the record. And they got their chance at that in 2022, when a police officer arrested him on a completely unrelated drug charge. They brought him into the station and they started questioning him. They also offered him a plea deal. They said that if he agreed to testify against Mike in the murder trial, they would go easier on him regarding those drug charges and even the other criminal charges that they could prove. And sure enough, he accepted the deal, meaning that the police now finally had enough evidence to go after Mike. It also helped that around this same time, they also arrested Ashlyn on drug charges. She was the woman that he hired to release that gas poison in that nightclub. And Ashlyn went through with the same process as this other guy did. She got arrested on the charges, but agreed to testify against Mike in exchange for a lesser sentence. And thanks to both of their testimonies, Mike was charged with 16 different charges, including racketeering, murder in the aid of racketeering, kidnapping resulting in death, and conspiracy to use a chemical weapon. So in the spring of 2024, his trial began. It lasted 99 days, fully 6 months from beginning to end, which maybe isn't that surprising because when you're facing 16 charges and some of them are as serious as murder or conspiracy to commit murder, and, you know, let's not forget using a chemical weapon, there's probably going to be a lot of evidence that you need to get through. And ultimately, Mike was found guilty of some of the charges, but not all of them. The good news is that the charges that he was cleared of were all pretty minor. He was found not guilty of 3 drug charges, but he was found guilty of the 13 others, including Jonathan's murder. And this definitely had all of Jonathan's friends and family very relieved.
Thank you, Jesus, for the justice that my son deserves.
Tell us how you're feeling hearing the verdict.
I'm very glad that Johnny got justice in court today. Before our family, nothing brings him back.
What do you want the community to know about Jonathan?
That Johnny was just Johnny. He's just from Kaneohe. That if he was here today, his son wouldn't have questions and we wouldn't need to give the answers. But, you know, for his mom and for our family, I'm just glad that he's found guilty on the charges against John. We really didn't have hope. We prayed and we had faith, but a lot of people told us maybe he wouldn't be found guilty, and that was really, really scary for us, just waiting for the verdict. We stayed here all week long. We never left the building. His mom stayed in the cafeteria and waited and waited and waited.
So now at this point, Mike was potentially facing life in prison several times over. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years probably, if not life in prison with no parole. I mean, murder, racketeering, all of these charges. Also, if you're convicted of getting money illegally, whether you're stealing it, scamming it, or whatever it is you're doing, you're not allowed to keep the cash. And if you use that money to buy something, you're not allowed to keep whatever you bought with it either. So let's say you steal enough money to go buy a house, you don't get to keep the house or the leftover money because remember, you bought it using money that's not yours. So now that Mike had been convicted of all these organized crime-related charges, the courts had to figure out, okay, well, how much of his money actually came from his criminal activities? And the idea was that if the courts believed that he paid for his house, his cars, or anything else with illegal money, the state could take those things away from him. And Mike had something like $20 to $25 million in assets. I mean, between his bank accounts, his house, his cars, everything else, he had a lot of money. So this was all going to be sorted out and worked out after that initial verdict came down in July. And it was going to be one of the largest forfeiture cases in Hawaii criminal history. However, Mike kept delaying, kept asking for a delay, then another, and kept pushing the date back. And then that hearing where they were supposed to have these answers, it never happened.
Again tonight with developing news from Honolulu's Federal Detention Center. That's where crime boss Mike Miskey was found dead this morning. As our Eddie Dowd reports, Miskey's death comes just weeks before he was set to be sentenced on more than a dozen charges, including murder.
Mike Miskey was pronounced dead just after 10 Sunday morning at the Federal Detention Center. Although the cause of death is still under investigation, multiple sources tell us it's being investigated as a suicide.
That's right. On December 1st, 2024, Mike was found dead in his prison cell. Now, of course, right away, everyone was suspicious. I mean, the possibilities were endless. Maybe Mike took his own life rather than face life in prison, but it also seemed very likely that somebody else could have killed him. Maybe another member of the North Shore Boys who also wanted to make sure that he would just never talk.
Guards are highly trained. There's a lot of security cameras. It's not a prison that's known for violence. So having a death occur there is a very rare circumstance. You're put in isolation. Sheets are removed. You don't have access to any sort of metal or rope or anything that could cause you harm in any way.
Now, there was also another theory, though, and it kind of goes back to the Aaron Hernandez theory. I don't know if you're familiar with that case. If you're not, don't worry. But basically, the theory is that if you stand to lose a lot of money, but you die before that ruling is made, then that money is protected and it can go to inheritance or life insurance or whatever it may be, whatever the circumstances are. So it was said that maybe this was a setup, or whether it was him taking his own life or an intentional hit that was put out on him so that his family would stand to inherit all of that wealth, all of the, you know, the 20-something million dollars worth of assets. So the officials ordered an autopsy, and it came back that Mike had died of a fentanyl overdose. And as for the method of death, the determination of whether it was a murder or a suicide or an accident or something else, it was still pending. They weren't ready to make a ruling yet. They also said that out of all of the possibilities, they thought that it was more than likely to be an accident. However, some people in the Hawaiian justice system think that that is very unlikely.
I know that they're thinking it's an accidental, but was it brought in? Who brought it in? Who else had access to it? Or was it a deliberate thing? Was it laced with something else? There's a lot of questions that are unanswered. The fact that what bothers me is, why is he the only inmate that suffered an accidental overdose death and not somebody else.
It's also worth mentioning that Mike never had a drug issue in the past. He never did heroin or opioids for fun, nothing like that. So the odds that he would go to jail and then suddenly decide to start using drugs, probably pretty slim. I don't know, maybe a little too convenient. So either way, even though he never made it to that sentencing hearing, he did spend the rest of his life in jail, behind bars. I wish it was longer, personally, but, you know, at least he was trapped behind there. And it sucks that justice wasn't fully executed in that way, but at least he's gone, right? I'll also note, though, that Jonathan's body still has not been found to this day. He has legally been declared as dead, and Mike was, of course, convicted for his murder, but his body was never found. So at least his family does have some closure in that sense, because there's answers, but it also must be a terrible feeling knowing that you can't properly bury the person that you love or give them a real funeral or somewhere as a place to go visit and speak with them. His son is also growing up without a father too. Now, one of the main questions I had about this case, which I haven't been able to get a ton of answers on, was remember James said he walked into Mike's house and saw Jonathan being tortured, that he was zip tied to that green plastic chair, and then he saw the pot on the of boiling water. Well, but then this other guy said that he went to Jonathan's house that very day that his girlfriend went to the spa, and that he took him on the yacht and threw him in the ocean. So clearly that would have made sense, or both of those could have been true if Jonathan wasn't picked up from his own house and that guy had picked him up from Mike's house and took him on the yacht. But both of those versions can't be true, unless there's something I'm not thinking about. So was this guy James just making it all up? I mean, it seems that he was speaking truth, so much so that people retaliated and tried to kill him, actually did successfully kill him in that jailhouse attack. So was the guy lying who took him out on the boat? Was that just how they disposed of the body? And maybe it wasn't the torture, and did he lie because maybe he wasn't involved in the torture, he was only involved in that part, and they didn't want to talk about him being held captive at Mike's house because that would have made the more charges in the future? I don't know, but I can't quite reconcile that discrepancy, so if you have any thoughts, please, please, please let me know. I know this was a wild one, and we don't really talk about, like, mob bosses or organized crime on here too much because, quite honestly, it scares me a little bit. I also don't talk about cartels because I personally live way too close to the border here. But it is an interesting one. And again, it was recommended by one of our listeners. So that's a reminder too, on our website, annieelise.com, if you have not only any case recommendation, but a case that has happened to you personally, that you're the survivor of, that you're a victim of, that you want to share with us, and you want to come out and speak and share your story, you can always submit that request online. Again, that's annieelise.com. Now, before we go, as a reminder, head over to annieelise.com to shop the fall merch collection. Everything is up right now, but we are going to be closing the store very, very soon, and it won't reopen until the spring or summer of next year. So lots of sold out pieces are back in stock, but for a limited time. Grab them while they're there. You guys have been saying how much you love these items. It's like the True Crime Diet Coke, the True Crime is my therapy, all sorts of cool designs that we designed with our team. And yeah, excited for you to check them out. So again, that's annieelise.com. So thank you so much for hearing Jonathan's story today. There is some sort of peace in my mind knowing that he and Caleb are together, knowing that they have been reunited, that the best friends are together again. But that doesn't make up for the fact that his son is now growing up without a father, that his family and loved ones lost him. I mean, it's just so senseless. Why? Because Mike couldn't deal with the fact that his son was the one driving recklessly and caused this accident, effectively causing his own death. I mean, how does that make sense? I don't know. It was a wild one, so I appreciate you sticking through. I'll be back on the mic with you first thing on Thursday, where we are going to break down all the things happening this week in true crime. That segment is called Headline Highlights. And then other than that, I will be back with you next Monday for another deep dive. All right, guys, until then, say it with me. Be nice. Don't kill people. Don't join any cults. Don't work for organized crime. And just be a good human and stay safe. All right, guys, thanks again. Talk with you soon. Bye.